So, hello listeners. This is Dr. Harry's podcast number 9, which should have been the August podcast, but it's a bit late now, so we'll have to call it the September podcast instead. I'm Julian Lasso, and I'm here with my friend and colleague, Dr. David Hohenmarsh.
That's me. Thank you very much.
As per usual, we're going to be discussing a number of articles, and I think they're all drawn from the BMJ this time. So they're not all COVID related this time around, but we are going to start off with a couple of COVID related ones. And the first one we were going to look at is this one: where are we on immunity and vaccines? And this is, let's see if I can find the reference for it. So it's BMJ, I can't read this. Excuse me, listeners.
Is that 2020?
Yeah, BMJ 2020. It's M3096 is the reference. So do you want to just quickly run us through this one?
Yes. Well, this is looking at the immunity, basically, and the different vaccines that are being tried in different countries or ready to try. I'm not going to go through a lot of this stuff because it's all quite complicated about the types of vaccine they're using, and some of them are using cold virus as a sort of
base.
Yeah. So, in China, they're going to test the vaccine on the military, and in Russia, they're starting mass immunization probably in October, although it's difficult to know how well tested it is. I shouldn't have said that. Live on.
They'll probably poison you now. Yeah, probably, some plutonium.
Yeah, probably. the interesting thing is that it's, you know, a lot of the immune response is related to T cells.
Yeah, so it kind of gets the, yeah. This article seems to start out by talking about where we are with producing vaccines, and then it kind of segues into a discussion of what protection from COVID has to do with T cell response and T cell immunity.
Yes.
And it ends up talking about whether or not the antibody test is either relevant to proper protection from COVID, or whether or not it would be better if it incorporated some kind of test of T cell levels.
That's true, as I understand.
Yes,
that's right. So the T cells, I mean, this goes back a long time. Even when I was at medical school, I think they knew about T cells.
Did they really?
It's a very long time ago. So anyway, the T cells, there are different types of T cells. There's the killer T cells, which actually directly kill the infected cells. And then there's the sort of helper ones that help the B cells to produce the antibodies. And I think they think that's partly how some people recover from the virus. But there are also regulatory T cells, which contain the immune response, preventing overreaction and damage to tissues. And that's that storm thing, but cytokine storm.
That's right.
The French people thought it was all caused by ibuprofen or something like that.
Oh, did they?
I think so.
I haven't heard that one.
They said don't take these if you've got COVID, because it will cause a cytokine storm.
So is that cytokine storm? Oh, yes, that's right. Don't take ibuprofen. Yeah, I do remember that, actually.
Yeah.
Is that that was right at the early days of COVID?
Right at the beginning.
Don't take ibuprofen to damp it down, because it might increase your cytokine storm.
Yeah. Yeah.
But so is this cytokine storm where your T cell regulatory function isn't working properly, and therefore your kind of antibody and immune response gets completely out of hand?
I think that probably is what it is.
Right.
But I think there was some suggestion that you know, if you have some anti-inflammatory painkiller, you could get a worse reaction to a wasp sting and things like that. So it obviously does have some effect on the immune response.
Right.
Or I guess it does. Anyway, they say T cells are made by virtually all people exposed to COVID or had COVID. Someone called Mala Maini, a professor at University College in London, said this is really important and exciting. we didn't think it was as exciting as the cricket.
We didn't think it was as exciting as he thought it was. I guess you had to be there.
Yes. And he said that emerging studies were showing that T cells are being generated and may last much better than antibodies.
Mm.
So hopefully the antibodies will give people some protection. And I think they're also saying that they can be boosted again as soon as they encounter the virus and could start...
Well, the T cells can.
Start to expand and make more antibodies, help the B cells to make antibodies.
Right.
So... so then they said, so the antibody testing isn't, there's not much point in that, and it's not very reliable, and it's probably gone
and it's
by.
Not necessarily a good indicator of whether you're actually protected from catching COVID again.
Yes, yeah.
Did you say there was some kind of existing test that does involve testing levels of T cells or enables you to?
Yes, it's this one, the one test that they can use for TB called the Quantiferon, I don't know how to pronounce it.
Quantiferon,
okay.
It sounds much nice and American and scientific. Quantiferon.
Yes, okay. And it relies on T cell reactivity.
Right.
So whoever wrote this article was very excited about that and thinks that, it could be used fairly soon to see how protective these T cells are and how feasible it is to use them as an additional test.
Right. So there may be better testing for resistance to COVID on the way, but which possibly involving testing for T-cell levels.
Yes.
But it's rather unclear what the implications of this are for vaccine production.
Yeah,
whether they're saying a vaccine will only be effective if you've got effective T-cell levels in your body and you've either got that or you haven't.
Yes.
Or if they're saying, perhaps if we produced a vaccine which had got antibodies and a dollop of T cells in it, I don't know if T cells are something that you can incorporate into a vaccine or what.
No idea.
So it's a bit unclear about that, isn't it? What its implications are.
Well, they say up here, we still do not know what level of immune response is needed
as protection from
a vaccine.
Mm.
So
well, it's interesting the T cells have got their own little society going. You've got helper T cells, regulatory T cells, and killer T cells.
Snooker T cells.
So that's quite interesting. Right. And and then we were going to, the other sort of COVID or directly COVID related one that we were going to have a look at is the management of post-acute COVID-19 in primary care.
Yeah.
The reference for this one is BMJM, that's M for Mother, 3026. This is quite lengthy, this article.
It's a very long one,
but a lot of it consists of saying, well, we don't really know. Well, we're not sure about this. Well, there's no definition of that. So it starts out by saying, defining post-acute COVID-19.
Yeah.
And it says there isn't a definition of post-acute COVID-19, but we're going to say if it goes on for more than 3 weeks beyond the onset of the first symptoms, we're going to call it post-acute.
And then after that, it becomes chronic, they say, after 12 weeks.
And then a bit further down it says, why are some people affected? Well, we don't know why some people are infected.
No.
And it says, what blood tests are required? And it says, well, just order the blood tests. It should be ordered selectively and for specific clinical indications. Just order what blood tests you think you ought to order.
Exactly.
And then it says, what are the symptoms? Well, post-acute COVID-19 symptoms vary widely. Yes, you get all sorts of symptoms. It could be anything, really.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So there's a lot of that.
Yes.
What should you do with the that's a bit more useful. How do you define a chronic cough?
Yeah.
The British Thoracic Society defines chronic cough as one that persists beyond 8 weeks.
Right.
Up to that time, unless there are signs of superinfection,
right,
whatever that is, or other complications such as painful pleural inflammation, cough seems to be best managed with simple breathing control exercises and possibly medications such as proton pump inhibitors.
Yes,
so that's quite useful. I don't know what you think about breathing control exercises, though.
They're saying this thing about that, when you've got something wrong with your chest, you use your shoulder and neck
instead
of your diaphragm.
And if you train people to go back to properly using their diaphragm, then that that kind of helps to control the coughing.
That's right. And then there was something about the breathing sort of in and out, which is the usual way. Or
yes.
Or you could get out and then in.
People, when they've got a cough, tend to forget about the breathing in and out. Just cough out and then they never breathe in.
And they talk about this aim for the inspiration to expiration ratio 1-2. So you go, one.
Yeah. And you go, and it's, ideally in through the nose, out through the mouth, isn't it?
That's very like sort of things people would do with yoga.
And meditation,
Meditation, yeah. Oh, and something called buteyko as well. Oh, yeah, and they mention pursed lips, slow deep breathing, diaphragmatic breathing, and yoga techniques. So buteyko.
Yes. Yeah. So I don't know what buteyko is.
No, it probably is another sort of Eastern sort of exercise type thing, I think.
But what I was going to say about that was what's your experience of people's kind of uptake of things like breathing exercises? Because if you give people things that are like a meditation discipline, two questions. First of all, is there a big overlap between what they're saying for breathing exercises and pulmonary rehab? I don't really know very much about what goes on in pulmonary rehab.
I thought in pulmonary rehab they do sort of structured exercise and things like that.
I think they probably do,
We don't really know much about this.
No, we don't. But secondly, it's one of these things where the people will go along to a class and do it while they're in the class and then stop doing it either 2 days afterwards or as soon as they walk out the front door.
Well, the meditation one you could quite easily do, just following the breath is quite an easy one to do, and it's also very relaxing.
Mm.
So it may be that would be, if you're feeling very anxious because you're breathless and you feel that you're not going to get better, that might be
helpful.
An easy one to do at home, and you can probably get it on Headspace and things like that online.
So it's worth a try anyway, isn't it?
But there was something in the BMJ some months ago where saying what you do is you have to lie on your stomach on the bed and eat honey.
Oh.
And open the window, something like that.
Put your feet out the window, put your feet out from under the bed clothes and make sure you've got the window open,
And listen to the cricket.
Yes. No, I think you made that bit up.
Did I have that?
So that's the breathing thing,
which we've kind of
hung up on, but I think that is probably the most common. But there's the fatigue thing as well further down.
Yeah.
Where it says the profound and prolonged nature of fatigue. In some post-acute COVID-19 patients shares features with chronic fatigue syndrome.
Yes.
We found no published research evidence on the efficacy of either pharmacological or non-pharmacological interventions on fatigue after COVID-19. So in other words, there's no evidence. They go on to say about restarting exercise.
Yes, a graded return.
Yeah.
But they also say a bit further down, there is much debate and controversy about the role of graded exercise in chronic fatigue generally.
Yes.
And that used to be the thing with chronic fatigue syndrome. Oh, you need to do graded exercise. You need to up it and then you'll get better.
Yeah.
And I don't think it worked particularly in some people.
No. We had a patient, didn't we, who was complaining about the fact she used to run a certain number of kilometres a day and she thinks that she hasn't got... thinks she had COVID-19, although it was never swabbed for, so she doesn't know for sure, but she had all the symptoms.
Yes.
And ever since then, she's had a real struggle to get back to her running.
Yes.
So she's obviously been trying to get back to her running. And here it says that limit activity, their guidance for what to do, limit activity to 60%, maximum heart rate until 2 to 3 weeks after symptoms resolve.
Yes.
And avoid high intensity training. So basically, wait till you feel like you're pretty much completely better before you start trying to reinaugurate exercise.
This is advice for sports people, isn't it?
Yeah. As well.
So
And she was describing this lung burn, which they mention.
Yes, yes.
I mean, I thought lung burn was just what you got anyway. Well, if you do strenuous exercise that makes you puff and pant, it tends to give you a burning sensation in your lungs. From what I can remember, it's quite a long time ago now.
And if you accidentally swallow your
a bee.
Yes. or your cigar.
Yes, if you're out running with a cigar on and you accidentally swallow it while you're running, that gives you lung burn.
That's not a good idea.
It does look cool, though.
Don't smoke and
run. So, just going on there through the sections. Chest pain.
Yes. I think this was just saying... investigators normal if you think there is anything.
Yes, the clinical priority is to separate musculoskeletal and other non-specific chest pain, for example, lung burn, from serious cardiovascular conditions. Well, that's what you normally do with chest pain,
I think that's true.
The first thing is to try to work out whether it's cardiovascular or just muscular.
Yeah. Yes.
And where the diagnosis is uncertain, or the patient is acutely unwell, urgent cardiology referral may be required.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, that's thromboembolism.
Yes, yeah. Maybe present several weeks after acute COVID.
So they're saying that quite often when patients are hospitalised with COVID, they're because it's an inflammatory and hypercoagulable state, quite often they're discharged with 10 days of extended thromboprophylaxis.
Yes, yeah.
There may be further monitoring which ought to take place after that.
Yes, I'm not sure what monitoring they're meaning there, though.
Well, no, me neither. But I suppose the hospital, you know, on their discharge should tell you what you're expected to do in that respect.
Yeah, I think one thing would be the, you know, the oxygen, the pulse oximeter, I suppose.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, actually, going back to the breathless thing, they mentioned about using pulse oximeters to monitor people's breathlessness.
Yes.
Pulse oximeters may be extremely useful for assessing and monitoring respiratory symptoms after COVID-19.
Yes.
I think quite a lot of people are thinking about giving the patient a pulse oximeter to take home and saying, let me have your pulse oximeter diary, in the same way that we quite often ask people to do blood pressure diaries.
Yes, exactly.
And then, you know, it gives you some kind of objective
idea
of what's happening with their breathlessness.
Yeah. Yes, and it also gives people a bit of...
It's probably quite reassuring for them. Left ventricular systolic dysfunction and heart failure after COVID-19 can be managed according to standard guidelines.
Yes.
So do what you would normally do with left ventricular systolic dysfunction and heart failure.
Yes, yeah.
Neurological sequelae.
Yeah.
So stroke, seizures, encephalitis, cranial neuropathies.
Yeah.
They all seem to be rare, but if they do come along... refer to a neurologist. Well, I think you could probably work that one out for yourself.
Yeah, and then there are some non-specific ones that might be related, which are headaches, dizziness, and cognitive mounting.
Or brain fog. Yeah.
Well, most people have that.
Yes, well, we certainly do, especially by Friday afternoon.
Yes.
The older patient.
Yes.
Support should be personalised with input from the multi-professional team.
Right.
So... you know, I mean, the thing with older patients is, I suppose, they're more likely to be multi-morbid.
Yes,
and
that's true.
Basically, COVID-19 is more likely to make their other comorbidities
worse, or to add an extra layer of
fatigue and breathlessness to the layers they've already got.
Yes.
So,
There's one word here that I don't quite understand. It's called sarcopenia.
Well, if you don't understand it, I certainly don't.
Maybe if someone could write it on the back of a postcard and send it to us.
Those who survive are at high risk of sarcopenia. Perhaps that's being sarcastic about your... About your blood test results?
Possibly, yes. Sorry, we're not very informative on that one.
And then, well, I think it's probably a reflection of this article to some extent.
Yes.
Mental health and well-being.
Yeah.
So again, they're saying, you know, you can get depressed.
Yes.
After COVID-19. I mean, yeah. I would imagine it's probably a bit like multi-morbidity. It's probably a bit difficult to unpick.
Yes.
Depression caused by COVID-19.
Yes.
As an illness from depression caused by the kind of effects of COVID-19, social isolation, you've lost your job, there's not much money around, the world seems to be coming to an end.
Yeah, they do mention that. They say that most of those things you've said,
the world coming to an end.
Yeah, it could affect uninfected individuals.
Yes.
So I think that's right.
So, yeah.
In fact, we've got, you know, lots of people phoning in saying the world's coming to an end. And
yes. Donald Trump was on the phone the other day. and they're saying, so well-being, mindfulness, social connection, self-care.
Yes,
But, I mean, luckily, the primary care is actually much better at a lot of that stuff now that we've got kind of social prescribing.
That's true,
and the health and social care coordinator. And,
You know,
at least we've got some go-to resources for, you know, actually referring people to the mental health team is as difficult as it ever has been. But we've got some other resources we can go to. So, and then social and cultural considerations is basically talking about the fact that people who are poor and elderly and from the minority ethnic groups are likely to do worse from the COVID epidemic than us toffee-nosed middle-class types.
Yes.
So you have to watch out for them.
Yeah.
For an important few, lockdown has worsened safeguarding concerns, such as the risk of child or intimate partner abuse, which is kind of a well-recognised effect now.
Yeah. I think that's about it. It just says that COVID illness can be prolonged, but people will recover without specialist input through a holistic and paced approach. But who knows?
No, we don't really know.
No.
Anyway, there we are. So that's management of post-acute COVID-19 in primary care.
Now,
the next one that we were going to discuss is kind of moving on a bit from COVID, but COVID-related. So this is appraisal and revalidation for UK doctors. Time to assess the evidence, it says. And this is BMJ... M for mother again, 3415. And the reason this is COVID related is, of course, because the appraisal has been suspended because of the COVID epidemic, and they're now
unsuspending it.
Yes. They've told you to put your suspenders back off.
Yes.
And they've taken your suspenders back off or whatever. But so the BMJ thinks it's time to have a little look at what appraisal is for, and what's it intended to achieve, and does it actually achieve those things? So I thought this article would probably ring a bit of a bell with you.
Yeah.
So
quite interesting, I must say.
Yes. Go on.
Well, like you're saying, they're looking at things. It's supposed to look at fitness to practice, performance management, which I'm not really sure what that means. It's probably applies more to hospital, I think. Learning and professional development, professional coaching and mentoring, meaning the appraiser could do that to the appraisee.
Talking to you about your career development and your kind of general, work-life balance and all that kind of stuff.
And then life coaching and well-being. So there's overlap between those two things. And then they're talking about redesigning it because it needs redesigning, perhaps.
So what conclusions do they say about how it achieves all those different objectives?
Well, I think one of the things that's quite important is that it probably costs the NHS £1 billion over 10 years, the existing system.
Right.
And it's supposed to be giving the public trust and confidence in doctors and making sure, knowing that their doctor is up to date
yes.
with stuff, but there's no
up good to date evidence. With research.
Yeah, yes, exactly. But there's no very good evidence that any of these things actually that are imposed by, you know, the system we've got actually has any effect on professional development or fitness to practice. And they're saying most doctors 97% revalidate through annual appraisals and a 5-yearly recommendation for the GMC from their responsible officer, so that means that 3% of people might not get through. So if 97% is a pretty good pass rate, isn't it, really?
Yes.
And then they're looking at, they're mentioning, you know, current roles of appraisal can include a combination of assuring a doctor's fitness to practice, performance management, blah, 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 all those things we've already mentioned. But again, how is this, you know, is there any proof for it?
Yes. I mean, one of the things that interested me about this article is that, I think it mentioned somewhere that there broadly isn't an equivalent system
in any other countries.
Yeah, that's true. So, you know, and it says that the Medical Board of Australia, on the subject of fitness to practice, for example, the Medical Board of Australia dropped the term revalidation and uses a professional performance framework to identify doctors at risk of performing poorly with strengthened assessment and management of medical practitioners who have received multiple substantiated complaints.
Yes.
So, in other words, they've got something that's much more targeted towards identifying people who are, you know, seem not to be performing very well and doing something about it.
Yes.
I mean, one of the things that they're saying is that there are lots of the way that appraisal has ended up evolving is that you've got lots of different people who say, "Oh, well, it ought to do this, it ought to do that."
Yes.
Lots of different stakeholders.
Yes.
And it ends up sort of being having lots of different purposes rolled into
it. Yes, that's true.
And possibly as a result of that, it doesn't fulfil any of those particularly well.
No, and there could be conflicts of interest.
The thing about professional performance, for example, because it's not specifically targeted at professional performance,
no,
it's probably not very good at actually monitoring or regulating or improving professional performance.
Yes, that's
because it does
saying.
That rolled in with a lot of other things.
Exactly. Yes, the inherent conflicts of interest and challenges around confidentiality. They're saying with professional performance. And something about the managers may wish to access confidential appraisal folders. So I think some of this is hospital-based stuff as well.
Yeah.
But there's definitely issues with that. And often it says, furthermore, the responsible officer is often a senior clinician or head of service within the organisation. So, you know, and I suppose one of the things with this is it a summative thing? You know, do you just do some exams at the end of every year and pass it and then you're fine?
Yes.
Or is it a formative thing to look at ongoing development?
Yes. Well, they mention that in here, I think. So there's a lot of emphasis on reflection.
Yes.
And to some extent, showing reflection through reflective writing.
Yes.
So you're meant to, when you fill out your appraisal, you're meant to show how you've reflected on this, that, and the other.
Yeah.
So it's not summative. You've got to meet this standard and then you passed it. It is meant to be about kind of, you know, reflecting on what you do as a GP. But they're saying that's not actually very well defined, and there's not very well defined evidence that's doing anybody any good.
I think they are saying that. They're saying there isn't, you know, good evidence that actually doing reflective writing is a way of, you know, looking at your own values and, you know, the things that are important to you,
yeah,
you think are important to your patients.
And of course, that it comes much more naturally to some people than it does to others.
Yes, exactly.
That reflective writing, yes, aspect of things.
But it isn't, you know, it doesn't have to be. It could be having a chat with people, or, you know, colleagues, or,
yeah,
you know, or... you know, or writing some poems.
But back to the performance management bit, one of the things that they're saying is that the person, you know, the identity of the person who is your appraiser, in a hospital context, it might be a senior clinician, may actually deter you from raising concerns,
exactly,
for example, about your own performance.
Or somebody else's.
Or somebody, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And I think that probably applies in primary care as well, perhaps to a lesser extent.
Yeah.
Because you probably have it, you know. So in fact, the appraisal process in some ways makes you say everything's all right, because otherwise otherwise you're going to struggle to pass your appraisal.
Yes.
So it could actually have the opposite effect of giving you an opportunity to to sort out any issues that you feel.
Yes, that's right. Because you know you have to get through that that process. The sort of coaching thing and mentoring thing, you know, what they're saying with that is it's all very well, and it could turn out, you know, people could report the appraisal process as a positive thing, but probably it feels more positive if it's gone all right.
Yes.
If it hasn't gone very well, then it's probably not going to feel very positive. But, and they are saying...
It also says this: most organised mentoring schemes attempt matching of participants.
Yes.
So you try to match the mentor to somebody, to a mentee who will be, you know, where there will be, you know...
Some understanding. Suitable,
there will be a good understanding between them. But but this is not possible in the existing appraisal process.
No. It says it's unclear how appraisal can meaningfully contribute towards well-being as well. But the coaching thing, it says there has to be a trusting relationship. Well, if you've never seen that appraiser before, then it can't.
That's difficult.
Or you don't know them, or they don't know you.
Yeah.
And then there's also, so the person is being supported and a non-judgmental approach.
Mm.
And I think this is going to be an issue because to a degree, the appraiser's got their approach on things. They've looked at the appraiser's, you know, the appraisee's records, and they'll pick things out and say, well, this should be done and that should be done. And it may not be the thing that's most important
to
that
the appraiser
at
the
time.
No.
So I think that, you know, they're different approaches. But on the other hand, it's a GP who does a GP's referral.
Mm.
So that's quite a good thing. There's something positive with it then.
Mm. Yes. What do you mean it's a GP who does a GP's referral?
Well, I mean, the appraiser is a GP.
Yes.
So he appraises another GP.
Another GP,
So he's got some understanding of that.
Yes.
If it was somebody totally unconnected.
Yes.
It would be really tricky.
It would, but I mean, there is what I was going to say is that there's who appraises you. There's a certain amount of kind of coxing and boxing that goes on every year because there's a limited pool of appraisers in your area.
That's true. Yes.
And everybody does a bit of manoeuvring to try to get an appraiser who they feel will be relatively congenial for themselves.
Yeah.
So that's a kind of I don't know whether that's a good thing or I mean, I think it's a problem that there is a limited pool of appraisers.
Yes.
And you know, you're naturally going to want to be appraised by somebody who you feel is kind of, you know, on your side, basically.
Yes.
And even
if
they say, well, I think you could do this differently, they're going to say it in a nice, sympathetic way. And,
that's
as opposed to coming and say, hey, for God's sake, hi, Bosch, you're doing everything like the dead patient, the dead. You're growing mould on the top of all your samples that you've left lying around on the side.
I think one of the other things they mention in here is about the bureaucracy that goes with appraisal and the amount of time doctors are having to spend on appraisal.
And that,
But it also affects, you know, people wanting to be appraisers as well. It must do too.
Yeah.
You know, it's a lot of input.
Yeah, and they said that they mentioned that I mean, I mentioned the bureaucratic disincentive. Yes. You know, a lot of people feel that the bureaucracy involved in appraisal and revalidation is one of the reasons why that they might not want to carry on being a GP indefinitely.
Well, precisely.
When they brought this in, there was quite a lot of, right, that's it, I can't bother that, I'm retiring.
Yeah.
And when they, in the COVID crisis, when they brought the old GPs back, they said to them, PS, you don't have to worry about appraisal or revalidation, which is kind of tacit. Admission that it's a big disincentive to people.
That's true.
I mean, I suppose it says there's a bit down the bottom here about redesigning appraisal, and I can't remember whether they actually come up with any super duper recommendations for. I don't think they do. Where they say, well appraisal would be much better if it was like this. I don't think they actually say that. But I think what they're saying is that there's pretty poor evidence for the way appraisal is now actually achieving very much of value.
Yes, well, I think one bit that they say here, clarity of purpose from the government and the GMC is the fundamental priority because...
Like the thing we were saying about performance, the way the Australians manage the performance, fitness to practice and performance management.
possibly looking for risk factors for poor performance, and it's quite difficult to know how you could spot that, and you know, and of course the people who get
complaints are one of the obvious things, aren't they?
Yeah.
I suppose dead patients are another obvious thing. There's more talent. I mean, there's quite a lot of information out there via things like QOF and you know, prevalence rates for you know, your different cohorts and your referral rates, the 2-week wait referrals.
There's also the patient feedback stuff, isn't there?
Yeah, the patient feedback stuff. So there is quite a lot of monitoring. Information that can be drawn on.
I think the trouble with that is, you know, one person's view about what is important in medicine isn't necessarily going to be the same as another doctor's view on that.
No. But let's say you weren't making any 2-week wait referrals, and you had very high,
late cancer presentations.
Then that would be a clear indicator that you were
not maybe very good. At that thing.
So there are probably much more kind of, you know, specifically focused and delineated performance indicators that they could look at instead of the existing way of doing it. I mean, I suppose that there are two things about this in a sort of broader context. Well, one of them is that I think it also raises questions about the CQC probe inspections. As I said to you when I came across this article, what's the evidence for the CQC inspections? A lot of the things that the CQC come and have a look at. I mean, hepatitis B status, for example. Is there really a reason why doctors are more prone to hepatitis B infections than the normal members of the population? The stuff that you do in your normal run of primary care doesn't actually expose you. If you're not doing minor surgery and stuff, you're not actually exposed to a risk of a hepatitis B infection very much, as far as I can make out. Well, that's just one example. The one that always gets your goat is the basic life support training every year.
Well, I just don't like imposed education, really.
But if anything, I think having that training every year confuses the issue rather than clarifies it. Because everybody that comes along says, A, they give the training in a slightly different way, and B, they say the guidelines have changed a bit from what they used to be. And after you've had it 3 or 4 times, my experience of it is you just get more and more muddled about it. I don't think it's useful, really. I think it's the opposite.
I think there are problems with imposed education, really. I think it doesn't mean that you've learned from it at all.
No.
You might have done the course, but you might have been asleep in the back of the room.
Well, quite. There's a lot of stuff like that in the CQC. I think that, you know, there's a lot of imposed stuff that's tick boxing and is, you know, policies for this, that, and the other that nobody ever reads, and that you wouldn't actually act on if those circumstances arose, because because you don't know even where they are.
No.
You know, there's a lot of tick box stuff that you really wonder what the value of it is.
Yes, it's true.
And they said, I mean, what they say about the appraisal system is that it becomes a little industry in its own right,
yes,
doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Like there are lots of people who offer you help with it. Yeah. There's the clarity thing run by the RCGP, right. which is a nice little money spinner for them.
Yeah.
And your local PCN or CCG will buy you into that system.
Yes.
Same thing with with the CQC. You know, there's lots of people making money out of giving you help with your CQC preparations.
Yeah.
And it becomes a little kind of self-justifying, almost like a little world of its own, really, doesn't it? So that's one thing, but the other aspect of it is, of course, that if you're saying, well, let's do away with appraisal or let's reshape appraisal, the big question is exactly what are you going to put in its place? The reason you've got appraisal is Harold Shipman.
Yes,
you know, the idea that if you don't have some way of monitoring GPs and GP practices,
there are going to be
rogue practitioners out who just take the law into their own hands and potentially just, you know, go mad and do really... And Harold Shipman, of course, was popular with his patients.
Yes, he was, yes.
So
it was the Undertakers that picked it up, wasn't it?
I can't remember. but you know, so I suppose that's a serious question that you've got to provide some kind of answer for.
Well, what they say about the redesign is... you should include patients and public as key stakeholders.
Mm.
If the aim includes improving public trust, health service...
But this is the problem, isn't it? You know, if Harold Shipman's patients and public thought he was a good doctor... So you also do have to have some kind of proper indicators that you're looking at.
Yeah.
You know, like the cancer ones and the referral ones that we were talking about earlier.
Yes. Then they're looking at, it says, other revalidation models should be explored. For example, online self-declarations, clinical audits and data signals that could indicate concerns.
Well, I think that's the kind of stuff I'm talking about, isn't it? The data signals,
Pausing appraisal, they think maybe it should be paused again immediately. In the same way that we would not recommend a costly and unevidenced clinical intervention that might do more harm than good.
Yeah.
So it's
well, I think that's a fair point, really.
Yeah.
But of course, will anybody actually take any notice of it? That's another story.
Well,
right?
That is, yeah. It's.
Well, that's a good one.
Yeah. Okay.
Unexpected weight loss, we'll have a look at. So, prioritising primary care patients with unexpected weight loss for cancer investigation, diagnostic accuracy study, and this is BMJ M2651. And this is a great big long research paper. The proper research papers are always quite sort of hefty because they've got all these kind of tables and all that kind of stuff in it, and lots of discussion in how they've sort of filtered their figures and everything.
Yes.
But basically, the kind of ins and outs of it are quite simple, I think. So they looked at cancer diagnosis in the 6 months after the earliest weight loss code, and they were trying to look at whether or not unexpected weight loss was a useful predictor of cancer.
Cancer diagnosis,
The threshold which is recommended by the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, is the 3% threshold. So if people who've got unexpected weight loss, more than 3% of them go on to be diagnosed with cancer.
Yes, yeah.
Presumably within this 6 month period, then it's a useful guide, and it should be added into the kind of things that you look for. But the research shows that it's not.
No, it's not a very
by
good
itself.
Guide. No, not by itself. No. Yeah.
So it says the positive predictive value for cancer that 3% threshold was above the 3% threshold for urgent investigation in male ever smokers aged 50 years or older, but not in women at any age. So if you're a man and you've been a smoker and you're aged over 50 and you've got unexplained weight loss
and your trousers fall down
and your trousers fall down when you come see the doctor, then you've probably got cancer, or you've got a more than 3% chance of developing cancer.
So if you had a 3.5% chance, that means you got to 96.5% chance of not having cancer.
That's true. But so if you're a woman and you're a smoker, whatever age you are, and you've got unexplained weight loss, it doesn't predict anything. You've got no greater chance of having cancer than the normality of people, if that's the only symptom that you've got. But the other thing that it says is that it may be a useful predictor in combination with other things.
Yes, other possible symptoms, like change in bowel habit or things like that.
But the trouble with that is that all of those other positive symptoms are things that you would probably think, we'd better investigate this further anyway. So it doesn't actually, as far as I can
There's quite a list of these things. Non-cardiac chest pain. Well, first of all, you'd have to check that it wasn't cardiac, I suppose.
Yeah.
And jaundice, well, that's fairly, rings bells that you might need to do some investigations for that person.
Absolutely.
Abnormal blood tests. There's a whole list of what blood tests could be abnormal.
And I think at the end it says about in the discussion, if I remember rightly, it says stuff about, an abdominal mass.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Rectal bleeding or the blood in the feces or whatever. As we say, change in bowel habits, all the stuff that you would normally think, we better organise an investigation to find out what's going on here.
And then it's got, halfway through it, well, towards the end, it's got this whole list of possible cancers related to various things.
Yeah.
Lung cancer, lymphoma.
Yeah, that's quite bewildering, isn't it?
Cancer of unknown primary.
Yeah.
Hepatobiliary, but it's just about every cancer that you can possibly think of, and some that you've never heard of.
Maybe.
I suppose
the other problem with this is that it says they were looking for cancer diagnosis in the 6 months after the earliest weight loss code. Well, there's a problem with that, isn't there? Because you don't. There's a problem with all recoding that you actually have to think to yourself, this is worth recoding.
Yes.
And we've seen people with unexplained weight loss.
Yes.
And I'm not sure whether we've actually recoded them with unexplained weight loss.
Yes.
Because you don't always find that recode. It doesn't always pop up when you're doing the consultation, does it?
No, exactly.
But you don't always kind of, unless you're regularly measuring people's weight.
Or they're regularly weighing themselves.
Or they come forward. We have had a couple of examples have come forward and said, I'm much thinner than I used to be and I'm not doing anything different. But I think that's quite a rarity, really.
Yes. I've had some patients who phoned up and said, I've lost weight and I don't think I've changed what I'm eating or doing, not doing any more exercise.
Yeah.
And it turns out then they suddenly remember that they'd gone to stay with their family during the lockdown period.
Who were all vegetarian.
Yes, exactly. So I think it's quite difficult to, for people maybe even to recognise that they're losing weight at first. So,
yes.
So it has to be 6 months from labelling it as...
This research worked. Yes, it was within 6 months of the first weight loss code being recorded on their notes. Yeah. And I think that is quite problematic, really, because there will probably be quite a lot of cases of unexplained weight loss out there that aren't labelled as such.
Yes.
I don't know where that... And I suppose the thing about women, about it not being a good predictor for women. But women are much more likely to, their weight is much more likely to yo-yo, I think, because they're much more likely to try to do something about it, to die, than men are, traditionally.
Yeah.
So, but that would make it not unexplained, but I suppose that could that could obscure the, whether it's explained or unexplained.
Yes, that's true. You also don't know many how many people with unexplained weight loss are out there who, you know, are not even recognising
it. No, that's
it.
Right. Yeah.
So it's a little, it's a quite a vague area, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, we had a guy who came to see us with unexplained weight loss, and he was in his 40s, and he wasn't doing anything different. And he said, "I've lost a load of weight."
Yeah.
And you do think it's quite concerning,
yes,
don't
you? Yes, you do. Yes. Yeah, so it will need some investigation, but whether it, you know, if it's investigation for, you know, for undiagnosed cancer is a is another issue.
And whether this particular piece of research actually changes your way of dealing with that clinically.
No, you know, this thing about you know, the male ever smokers over 50, and then all patients with concurrent clinical features, and then all the blood tests, and as you say, abdominal mass, pain, jaundice, you know, lymphadenopathy. I mean, these things, dysphagia, hemoptysis, in men and women, but both of these, they're separate issues for a 2-week wait anyway.
Yeah, you wouldn't just not investigate those just because there was no unexplained weight loss with them. You would investigate them in any case, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
So, yeah, so I guess this I mean, it's an interesting piece of research, but probably the upshot of it is carry on what you're doing now.
Yeah, is it going to change practice at all? I mean, but it's certainly, you know, it is, like you say, it's a worrying issue when somebody says, "Oh, I've lost loads, I've lost 2 stone in the last 2 weeks or something."
Yeah.
Or, you know, and you just, you have to investigate it anyway.
Try to find out what's going on. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
So
how are we doing then?
I think we've done about sort of 40 minutes, so I think we'll do one more.
Okay.
And the one that I've got left is breast cancer. Study and this again is probably reasonably straightforward. Study claiming that screening women in their 40s saves lives found the opposite, say critics. And this is BMJ M3191. This isn't actually a research study in itself. It's a kind of article about research that's been published in the BMJ. Screening was carried out at 23 breast units in Great Britain, and the women were followed up for a median of 22.8 years. At 10 years follow-up, the study found 83 breast cancer deaths among the 53,883 women in the early screening group, so the ones who'd been screened at age 40, compared with 219 in the control group of 106,953 women. So the control group is twice as big, basically, as the screening group.
Yes.
So that's a that represents a 25% reduction in breast cancer mortality.
In the early screening group.
Yeah. However, no significant reduction was observed thereafter, as 126 deaths, early screening, versus 255 deaths, control, and you have to bear in mind that control group's twice as big as the early screening group, occurred after more than 10 years of follow-up. No significant difference in all-cause mortality was found between the two groups by the end of follow-up. So, and then...
and then there's a lot of complaints.
So the press release about the study said, breast screening women in their 40s saves lives. And then somebody else said, well, you really shouldn't say that.
Yeah.
Vinay Prasad, so that was Stephen Duffy, who was the lead researcher from the Queen Mary University of London. However, Vinay Prasad, associate professor at the University of California, San Francisco, so this is the Americans telling the British they're wrong. I don't like the sound of that. It's disappointing to see the authors of this study continue to promote misleading rhetoric. Saves lives means that women, as a result of doing this, live longer than those who do not do it.
Yes.
That did not occur in this data set. Quite the opposite. Well, I'm not I'm not 100% sure that this data set actually shows that, that screening kills you, which is what he seems to be, or increases your rate of mortality, which is what he seems to be saying. Yeah. Yeah. But it does seem to show that after 10 years, there's no difference whether you've been screened or whether you haven't been screened.
No. I think the other issue with these big numbers and differences in the numbers in each group, you know, you don't know what, there are other sort of confounding factors in that at all. It could easily be.
Yeah.
It's not sort of balanced for that sort of thing. Anyway.
No. But I mean, in some ways, the interesting comments come from, I can't remember who it is down the bottom that says that the treatment of breast cancer has completely changed since the trial was initiated.
Well, is this Carsten Juul Jorgensen?
Yeah, that's him. Carsten Juul Jorgensen.
Yeah.
So he's the acting director of the Nordic Cochrane Centre in Copenhagen.
Right.
He says, since the trial was initiated, breast cancer mortality in the UK... he probably didn't talk like that.
No, no,
anyway, he says it's been, you know, basically, it's been breast cancer mortality has been cut in half by major improvements in treatment, improving centralisation and specialisation of care, as well as better systemic treatment.
Yes, yes.
So he's saying that screening... it's probably no longer the big determining factor.
No.
It's how you're treating the breast cancer when you find it.
Yes.
It's so much better now.
Yeah.
I mean, what I said to you before was that in a way, that the kind of length of follow-up perhaps possibly obscures the issue. Because, you know, they're saying that the differences in mortality rates beyond 10 years tend to disappear between the people who are screened and the people who aren't screened.
Yeah.
But if you left it 100 years, they'd completely disappear because everybody would be dead.
Well, that's true.
So if you take that far enough, it's bound to happen.
Yeah, so basically we shouldn't screen for anything because we're all going to die.
Because we're all going to die then. So...
yeah, it says something about... substantially fewer lives to be saved. I think that's what you were saying.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So the study tells us very clearly that any benefit of breast screening in this young age group is very small in absolute terms, as you would expect due to the inherently low risk of breast cancer death before age 40.
Yes, yes.
We must then consider the considerable cost required to expand the programme. They might be used for greater good elsewhere.
Well, absolutely.
But also, I mean, we've kind of... summarised other articles in the past about increasing the sort of, you know, breast cancer screening program, but screening programs in general.
Yes.
And the trouble is that you can get, I mean, as the sort of screening technology becomes more and more sensitive, they tend to pick up more and more things that might be, and people can end up having... surgery
for
things that might not have turned out to be serious at all.
Yes.
So in some ways, it kind of it can generate artificial figures of you know, we've managed to fix this problem when in fact there might not have been a problem there in the first place.
Well, that's right. 18% of the women in the intervention group experienced a false positive result during the trial period. So that's quite a number.
Mm.
That's almost one in five, isn't it?
18%, yes, correct. 20% is one in five. Yeah, well done.
During the trial period, that is one of the important things that must be considered because, you know, those people are going to be distressed, aren't they?
Yeah.
And, you know, if it's a false positive, then that isn't... it says that. As we know, this has important negative psychological effects, he said.
Extending the breast cancer study to lower age groups is what they're saying is that the merits of that are very dubious, really.
Yes. Yeah. So they said this trial doesn't give enough information to see whether it's...
So, of course, we should say that this kind of fits in with the BMJ's broader too much medicine agenda, which, you know, they have definitely got, and which we tend to sort of share to some extent.
Yeah,
so,
that's true.
You know, other people may look at this differently.
Of course, yes.
and so on.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
But so okay, well, I think that will probably do for this podcast.
I think that everyone's gone to sleep.
Yeah, so thank you very much, everyone. Everyone who's listening.
Yes.
The huge crowds of people. So thank you very much for listening.
Yeah,
and we'll have another go next month if we can manage to get round to it a bit more properly this time.
Yeah.
Goodbye.
Okay. Cheerio.